Greetings, comrades, and welcome back to yet another late episode of the Comrade Cast. As you can see, I've got a fresh new look. We've had our biannual removal of the hair, where I go from a kind of Che Guevara style to something a little bit more clean cut and professional. But in case you're wondering, yes, that is the reason why this episode is a couple weeks late, is because it took so long to get the haircut done and the beard trimming done that I had to delay the show. No, that's not it. The reason is still my son. He's continuing to really shake it rough. And because of that, we are all shaking it rough in tandem with him. I mentioned in the last episode that he's really started teething, and it's just gotten worse to the point where he's entered, which is apparently something that happens with a lot of kids, especially around the year mark, where they enter like a sleep regression stage where they start to struggle to sleep through the night again. And that's exactly what's happening with our baby boy. I'm not sure what exactly it is. I'm pretty sure it's the teething pains, but he is really struggling to stay asleep. And yeah, unfortunately, it's draining us all. And then on top of that, he's going through some kind of weird, like, separation anxiety, which, again, is something I read about. Apparently, it's common with kids when they start to, like, crawl and move around, where they recognize that, oh my God, I'm different from my parents. I'm a different entity, and it freaks them out. And my son is definitely going through this, because every time we try and put him down and let him walk around or crawl around, he just looks around and then he starts to cry and then comes back towards us, wants to be picked up by one of us. But it's really interesting just how kids are so different, right? Because with my daughter, it was very much so the opposite. The second she started moving, she was gone. She was out there exploring, playing, doing her own thing. My baby boy, on the other end, has had a much different reaction. And there have been times when we finally get him to sleep, and I'm so bagged. I'm just sitting in front of my computer, just like totally defeated, just trying to get up the energy so I can play some games and distress a little bit before going to bed or going to work. On top of that, it's been a little bit difficult for me to get up the energy to talk about what we are going to mainly be focusing on today, which is the continuing unfolding tragedy in Gaza. But before I talk about Israel, I want to take a detour, but don't worry, this is going to come together. There is a band out there, one of my favorite bands of all time. They're called VNV Nation. Not sure if you guys have heard of them. They're not like super popular or anything. They're media popular, especially if you're into any kind of electronic music. But for me, the reason I like this band is not because so much of the melodies itself. It's because of the lyrics that Ronan Harris, the lead singer, writes and performs. I feel like his lyrics are very good at both making you think and cutting to your emotional core. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. What I'm here to talk about is the actual motto of the band, what VNV stands for, because it is one of my own personal mottos and rules that I live my life by. So what VNV stands for is victory, not vengeance. And to me, this is a very succinct motto, because I think a lot of issues and conflicts and, you know, really burning hatreds between people come from when we decide to, rather than pursuing victory, we pursue vengeance. Those times when we may be the victorious party, but rather than being humble in our victory, we have decided to push things too far and push the envelope. And for me, this will always be a very powerful motto, because I have seen, and we can see, the devastation that pursuing vengeance wreaks upon the world. And when it comes to what Israel is doing in Gaza, it's like they're no longer pursuing victory. They're not even pursuing vengeance. At this point, it seems like they're pursuing annihilation. I don't really have, again, much of a template planned out for this episode, because things have been so discombobulated at home. I've just not really had much time to write out the kind of templates and notes that I usually do before a show. I apologize if this is a little bit scattershot, but I really wanted to spend some time and revisit what's going on in Gaza. I was, at the end of the year, hopeful that we might have some sort of beneficial resolution coming out of Gaza, but at this point now, I'm completely and utterly black-pilled on the situation. And I'm a guy who has a very high tolerance for political discussion, geopolitical discussion, something that not everybody has. And even I, with such a high threshold for being engaged with current events and wanting to be in the know of what's happening in the world, even I am getting overwhelmed by what's happening in Gaza. And it's tough. It's legitimately tough sometimes to continue to follow what's happening and continue to educate yourself about what's going on in Gaza, because I feel like it's rapidly becoming the worst thing that we've ever seen happen in our lifetimes, pretty much. So let me try and bring everybody up to speed with what has been going on in Gaza. So let me pull up here. This is the map, the military map that they have on Wikipedia. This is currently the projected control of the Gaza Strip as of today being the 14th of March, 2024. Just briefly here, the blue represents Israeli occupied areas. Red represents Palestinian control. And then we have a couple little dots here. The red dotted line that you see, that is the maximum extent that Hamas advanced during October 7th, their attack on October 7th. And the yellow here, this is the evacuation zone around the Gaza Strip, which Israel has issued for its own citizens. And then lastly, the blue outlines, the blue dotted outlines, these represent areas which Israel has demanded that Palestinians evacuate from. So they've put, as you can see, evacuation orders all around the northern part. And now you can see about half of the southern part, we have evacuation orders in place. So as we can see, Israel has pretty much gained complete and total control of the northern part. Only a few pockets of Gaza City remain uncontrolled by them. And they also now are moving deep into the southern parts around Khan Yunis. And the big thing that a lot of people are worried about is effectively Netanyahu has pretty much said he intends to invade Rafah. It is now a little bit up in the air. It seems like he has backed off on that for now, but I'm assuming it's probably going to come. Despite the fact that Joe Biden has said that invading Rafah would be a red line for the United States, and then immediately contradicting that. And of course, Netanyahu doesn't take him seriously at all. He doesn't believe this is a red line at all. And I fully believe that he intends to violate it. As you would imagine, considering we have these vast declared areas of evacuation, almost the entirety of Gaza's population is now centered in and around Rafah, a area which is not designed and does not have the infrastructure to accommodate the vast amounts of people moving there. And then on top of that, you add a military invasion in a area where there's millions of refugees. It's just a recipe for a catastrophe. And that is only projecting future suffering, which is going to add on to the already incredible amount of suffering that is happening in Gaza. As we discussed at the start of the invasion, Israel cut off food, they cut off water, they cut off fuel going into the Gaza Strip. Aid has been extremely limited. Anything that comes through Egypt, and that has enormous difficulties. For example, you have Israeli protesters who are trying to prevent trucks going through, trucks with fuel, trucks with food that people desperately need to go. They're trying to prevent those from going into Gaza. But things have only gotten worse from there, to the point where I think a lot of people who are watching what's going on are just wondering what the hell is going on with the Israeli military. During this invasion, the Israeli military seems to be waffling in between total monstrosities and war crimes being committed and sheer incompetence. What do I mean by this? Well, of course, we have seen the infamous TikToks which have come out of the Israeli army. The Israeli army, well known for its TikToks well before this time, have really elevated their social media presence to the next level by just blatantly posting their war crimes on TikTok. I'm sure some of you guys have seen what has been available for viewing. Things like Israeli soldiers riding around on children's tricycles that they stole from their houses. It's just messed up stuff. And a lot of people, you know, have been asking, why is the Israeli army doing this? Why is this happening? This seems like amateur hour. This is stuff that doesn't really happen in other militaries. While we did start to see this kind of social media influence in the Russo-Ukraine war, that was really at the start of the invasion. And since then, both sides, I think, have really made an effort to crack down on the social media presence of their militaries, because it can lead to, obviously, their positions getting exposed secrets getting exposed, battle plans getting leaked. Military and social media, not usually a good combination. So people are wondering where this is coming from and why this is happening in the Israeli military. And some people are suggesting it's because they can just act without impunity. And I do think that there is maybe some of that. But to me, it's more, we have to remember the Israeli army that's fighting right now. This is a conscript army. This is not an army of people who want to be there. This is an army of people who have been called up from their houses, from their homes, and sent there. The army fighting in Israel is not the professional, trained army of volunteers like you would see in something in the United States, right? Even though in the United States, you have a lot of young people joining the military, may not have a lot of life experience, may do a lot of stupid shit. At least when they're signing up for the military, this is something that they have decided that they're going to do. This is something that they volunteered for and have said, I'm going to do for the foreseeable future. And I think that brings a much different mentality to combat rather than taking a bunch of conscripted 20 to 30 year olds, then throwing them into battle and then injecting all this kind of fervor and zeal into them. Like, we are in this apocalyptic war and we have to do everything to save the state of Israel. Like, it's, again, you have this kind of propagandistic zeal injected into a lot of young kids who necessarily don't want to be there. Again, recipe for a fucking disaster, recipe for catastrophe. And I want to go back to that example of America in Afghanistan just for a sec, because we've seen a lot of horrible things happen in Gaza over the past months. We haven't even talked about the Flower Massacre. We haven't talked about the systematic destruction of civilian infrastructure that's going on, schools, universities, hospitals. Despite all that, to me, the worst thing that they're doing still is this restriction of food and water, because this is effectively starving everybody and punishing them for something that the overwhelming majority of them didn't have a hand in. Whenever I talk about this kind of issue, I do get a lot of people, and I'm again convinced that Israel does pay bots and people to do this, and they go around and they'll try and post pro-Israel, we're getting them type of arguments on various videos or whatever that might be critical of them. So for those people, what I want to ask is that after the devastation of 9/11 and America retaliated against the Taliban, how come it was after the devastation of that attack, there was never any talk of from the American army, oh, we're going to shut off all the electricity to the country. Oh, we're going to take away all their food and water. Oh, we're going to destroy their hospitals and schools. How come none of that collective punishment for the Afghans was necessary in the hunt for the Taliban? Why is it now all of these extreme and cruel measures have to be implemented against the citizens of Gaza because you're trying to get Hamas? One of the arguments I've heard is that all of the people in Gaza are guilty because they won't fight against Hamas and turn over Hamas to Israel, which to me is the most ridiculous argument you ever heard in your life, right? Not only is that, okay, bud, you've outed yourself as a complete and total psychopath, let's just apply that logic generally. Let's just say that you have a bunch of terrorists who take a group of civilians hostage, and then the police roll up and just kill everybody. And they say, well, the citizens, they didn't really turn against the terrorists, so they're just as culpable as them. We were justified in killing everybody. There's no way you'd accept that. But how come for some reason, all the people in Afghanistan weren't collectively responsible for what the Taliban did on 9/11? But for some reason, all the people in Gaza are collectively responsible for what Hamas did on October 7th. It's obviously extreme. It's obviously unjustified. It's obviously a war crime. And I like to think that I have been, and I like to think that I am a lot more sympathetic to Israel than a lot of people on the left might be. There are some discussions and talking points around Israel that I'll hear left-wing people bring up that I really don't like. We actually had a little bit of a debate on this on our Discord, which is one of the things I don't like is when people will bring up or when people will use the talk of Israel being an illegitimate settler society on colonial land In the West Bank, there's absolutely no question that that is happening, that the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are illegal colonies. But my point here is more towards the state of Israel itself, in the sense that is the state of Israel itself colony or a colonial state? Absolutely not. Well, it may be a state engaged in colonialism, that doesn't make it a colony. And I really dislike this kind of rhetoric, because I see it leading down a dark road very quickly, where you get to, well, Israel doesn't have the right to exist because they're an illegitimate colonial society, people brought from other countries and put there. I hate that argument for a couple reasons. Again, like I said, it leads down that dark path to where you undermine the state of Israel itself, but it also undermines a lot of historical context, which this is the home of Jewish people. This is where they originated from. There is a lot more historical context and historical legitimacy for the state of Israel than there is for something like the United States of America or Canada. And for me, as someone who is a fan of history, and not just like specific parts, all of human history, I don't think it's possible to come away from reading the history of the Jewish people and not want to root for them. A people who have almost consistently throughout human history been mistreated, abused, denied services and rights that were given to other people. They are the ultimate underdogs. And I, like many people, always want to root for the underdogs. And I think part of what's happening now is that this is the first time in 6,000 years of human recorded history that the Jewish people are not the underdogs in this current scenario. And it's really messing with a lot of people's perceptions. I 100% believe the state of Israel has the right to exist. And I want to see the Jewish people survive and thrive and live happy, comfortable, safe lives. I also want this for the Palestinians. And I absolutely do not think that this is in any way a mutually exclusive goal. But unfortunately, so long as this fucking ghoul is in charge of the country, nothing is ever going to change. Nothing is ever going to get better. And fortunately, the one thing I am optimistic about right now is I do think that Netanyahu's time is coming. I think that his coalition is struggling. And from all indications, from the attitude of the Israeli people that we have, they are not happy with the way the invasion is going. Unfortunately, it seems to be more split on we want to go harder or we need to reel this in. But the one thing, though, is that people are not happy with Netanyahu. And I hope, maybe beyond hope, that somehow they're able to get this school out of there and eliminate the Orthodox influence that faction has on Israeli politics, because they are destroying the country. They are hurting it beyond measure. And I hope that one day Israeli citizens will see that Benjamin Netanyahu has done incredible damage to the country of Israel. And then now, of course, this brings us to Joe Biden, who has been signaling his strong support for elections in Israel. And of course, Netanyahu is losing his freaking mind. His government was like, the people of Israel will decide who leads us, not America. And you guys realize that Netanyahu won by the skin of his fucking teeth last time. It's not like he's this overwhelmingly popular, glorious leader, but that's not going to be enough. But I think just standing against Benjamin Netanyahu is not going to be enough for Joe Biden. He absolutely needs to do something to rein in Israel or try and stop it or negotiate some sort of ceasefire. America absolutely has the power and capacity to achieve something like this, and they are not using it effectively. But like I said, I'm extremely black-pilled with the way that things are going in Palestine. Like I said, outside of Benjamin Netanyahu's government maybe going down, I don't have very much optimism about anything at all. But on that, I don't know what else to say. I felt like I had to talk about this. I wanted to talk about this, even though it's hard, even though it's difficult. It's one of the most important things that is happening right now and could be one of the most important things that happens in all of our lifetimes. So it's important to talk about this, to continue to be in the know about what's happening. But the one thing I want to stress is that this is absolutely, yes, of course, this is an extremely serious topic. We're talking about very serious issues that many of us have direct and close personal links to. People are going to get heated. emotions are going to run high, but I hope that somehow we can all still manage to maintain some semblance of respect for one another and try to refrain getting too personal with individual people when talking about this issue. That's probably the only way we're going to get through this without tearing each other apart. So I think that's about all I can handle talking about Israel-Palestine for now. I am always going to be keeping a close eye on what's happening. But that being said, I certainly don't consider myself as knowledgeable about Middle Eastern politics and history as I do in comparison to Eastern European politics and history. Definitely much more my wheelhouse and area of expertise. And while I like to think that I've definitely got a better grasp of the geopolitical situation here than your average Joe, I don't think I can really provide the same level of knowledgeable commentary about the situation in Israel that I can in, say, something like the Russo-Ukraine War. And with that, I do want to talk a little bit about the Russo-Ukraine War, because I'm seeing some interesting narratives about what's going on right now. Again, most of the main fighting is happening around Andriivka, which did fall since we last convened. And thankfully, it does look like the Ukrainian line has stabilized. I've been watching this pretty closely over the last couple weeks or so. And there were some pretty rapid, especially for this particular war, advances from the Russian military. After they took Andriivka, they took pretty much all of this kind of open territory here in very quick succession. This is a very quick grab for the Russians, and I was worried that this could become a significantly larger breach in the Ukrainian lines. However, it looks like the Ukrainians have stabilized here. I've noticed that around Orlivka, the Russians have stalled. They've been trying to capture this village for about a week or two, and they haven't been able to advance. One of the things we can see that has been stalling, or I'm assuming is probably stalling the Russians, is that we actually have some natural barriers here. We've got some small rivers. We've got some small lakes. Oh, yeah, really small. But you understand what I mean. In comparison to these wide open fields, the Russians are going to start running into some natural defenses. And it looks like the Ukrainians have managed to, for the meantime, stall the Russian advance. But when I talked about earlier about interesting narratives, I've seen a lot of people throwing in the towel for Ukraine and saying, like, Ukraine is done. Ukrainian victory is impossible. Well, we even had the Pope come out and say, Ukraine has to have the courage of the white flag. Just ridiculous stuff because, again, Ukraine is the defending party in this scenario. They're the one being aggressively invaded. It seems like a pretty bad precedent to set when you're saying that, oh, when you're being invaded by your neighbor, what you should do is just give up. If things don't look like they're going your way for this moment, just give up. But the thing about warfare is that very famous saying definitely rings true, which is that very famous saying is true, which is that the victor is not victorious until the vanquished considers himself so. In other words, the war is going to go on until one side feels that they are defeated. And when it comes to that political will to resist and that political will to keep on fighting, I think that Ukraine still has that in spades. They're near ready to give up the fight, and I don't think that they're anywhere near ready to throw in the towel. And of course, by that token, the Russians aren't either. The Russians now feel like they have the upper hand, and I again do think that it's very fair to say that currently they have the momentum, but I don't think that political will for Ukraine to resist is going to go anywhere. Where the political will is going to dry up, and we've talked about this before, is going to come from Western countries who have decided that Ukraine isn't worth supporting anymore, isn't worth giving arms to anymore, isn't worth giving aid to anymore. That political will, I'm very worried, is going to dissipate relatively shortly, particularly in the United States. One of the things that really frustrates me about how a lot of the aid that is donated to Ukraine has been reported is that it's always reported it's this just big cash sum. They're just sending over to them, like, no questions asked. That's not what's happening. I've seen, like, news stories all the time where They'll be like, Ukraine offered a $43 billion aid package, and that includes the value of the equipment that they are being sent and the value of the munitions and other logistical supplies that they might need. Again, it's not these governments are just cutting them raw checks. In some cases, that is happening, and part of this aid package is still, of course, money and funds to be able to buy what they need. But these packages get always misreported as basically being, again, these kind of lump sum cash payments. I've also seen one thing that really bothers me is like Ukraine set to receive $4 billion in aid from Canada, and that'll be the headline. And in the actual body of the article, you'll come to find that this aid has already been promised to Ukraine 6 months ago. And this is just the shipment being sent out. This is not just coming out of nowhere. And, you know, it's all going over. I feel like a more accurate headline would be that Canada sends the already agreed upon aid to Ukraine or something like that. Then the last thing I want to say about this is that the actual equipment that Ukraine is getting from these countries, by and large, they're like bottom tier bargain bin stuff that they're giving out. That is, of course, until recently when we saw some more advanced main battle tanks like the Abrams, like the Leopard 2s. But the Leopard 1 is a shit fucking tank. It's a terrible tank. So the aid that Ukraine is getting is, again, stuff that has just been sitting around a lot of the time and isn't really being used anyway. And if anything, a lot of these countries are going to save in sending a lot of that equipment to Ukraine. Now they no longer have to maintain it. Now they no longer have to worry about it. This is something that happens very frequently in the United States with police departments, where rather than, you know, the military wanting to hold on to some old outdated piece of equipment, they'll donate it to a police force. And, you know, then they take on the maintenance and then they take on the care for it that the military no longer has to worry about. And that's why you have, you know, fucking American cops rolling around in APCs. And there's something similar happening here, which is that a lot of the aid that is being sent is stuff that is just lingering in storage anyway and taking up manpower to maintain and repair and keep functional, and of course money. So I wish that there was better communication about what exactly is happening and what exactly Western countries are doing for Ukraine and what they're sending to Ukraine. But good communication in our politicians, good communication in our media, not going to happen. That's a way too big of a pipe dream. Anyway, that's going to be it for this episode. I got to keep it a little bit shorter because still, unfortunately, I got lots of stuff that needs to be taken care of, lots of stuff that needs to get done. So unfortunately, I got to get back to it, guys. So this has been the Comrade signing off for now. And until next time, you guys take care.